That's all we have time for. Thank you, Trudette, B-Train, Starcale, and Walnuts. Coming up, all whole bunch of great programming here on 2SER. Stick around. We've got Miguel Migg's remix of Rasmus Faber taking us out. Stick around. You're on 2SER.
Community stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome, family and friends, fans and fiends, to today's edition of Word for Word. I want to thank you for tuning in today. I'm Benjamin Norris, and it's simply a delight to continue to work on this show for the Joy Network, which has already featured some of the community's strongest voices. In the tradition of this ongoing program, I continue to look at powerful stories and insights into the life and lifestyle of some incredible people. Each week, we will chat with those in and around the community who have inspired us, entertained us, but mostly they've made an impact on the queer community of Australia. Today's guest is one of them. This man calls Melbourne home and has quickly built his way up in the international comedy industry, now selling out shows around the world. He is a regular at the Melbourne Comedy Festival, and this year he hosted ABC's Comedy Up Late and performed at the Sydney Opera House for the Just for Laughs Festival. Last year, he was nominated for the Best Newcomer Award at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, and this year his show, Show Pony, won the Adelaide Fringe Weekly Best Comedy Award. His hilarious stand-up is beloved by crowds and critics across the globe, and nothing is off limits as he discusses everything from his relationship with his mum to his sex life. You may have even heard him as he regularly appears on Kiss FM, Nova, Triple M, Triple J networks. I'd like to welcome you, and I'd like to welcome Nath Valvo to Word for Word.
From the ages of like 12 years old to 15, I think I was figuring out I was pretty different.
Like, we used to sell tickets through our MySpace page.
That's so good.
I turned 35 this year, and I reckon something happens in your early 30s. You stop caring about people that aren't in your direct circle.
Here's a little rule. The more things your watch can do, the less time people want to spend with you, dickhead.
There's nothing worse than predictable comedy.
Because when I'm up there holding the mic, I'm completely in control.
I'm really excited about our next guest, an outstanding comedian who only loves one thing more than comedy.
Oh my God, hello. I'm Nate, very happy to be here.
And to think for a second that, you know, people around me might think that I would use that, that can affect relationships. Thank you for reading out the intro I emailed you.
What's strange about comedians is how much we know about some incredibly personal stories, but then how little we actually know about them, really. Isn't that weird?
Comedians are very good at choosing what you know about us.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Because you'll go very deep on stuff that you'll think, TMI, mate, but then we don't really know.
But really, I think definitely a common trait from most comedians is control freaks. Most of us are control freaks, whether that be social situations or, you know, that. And people are like, oh, I don't know how you do it. Jump up in front of thousands of strangers and talk about your life. I'm like, it's the best, because when I'm up there holding the mic, I'm completely in control of what you see of me and what I'm
what we know of you.
Yeah, I'm all for it. Having said that, I can't honestly tell you something I don't talk about. No, I can't think of anything that's off limits, to be honest. Like, if there's a good joke, I'll do it.
Is there a pressure to always be funny?
Not so much anymore. I turned 35 this year, and I reckon something happens in your early 30s. You stop caring about people that aren't in your direct circle of like five people. I reckon I used to have such a huge circle of mates, like gigantic group messages, always going out with heaps of us, you know. If I had birthday drinks, I'd have to have like 30 or 40 people. You know, you obsess over like numbers and groups in your 20s. Then I reckon early 30s, you only really start giving a shit about the ones that you do not have to pretend, act, be funny. Maybe also because for a living, I constantly perform and share with so many strangers that I really do love chilling out with the people that just carry the conversation for me and I can just sit back and listen.
But what about those strange people that come up to you and go, oh, you're a comedian. Do you have a go-to story that you try and quickly pump out?
Oh, I get really sassy and I probably come across as a massive prick. because people will go, oh, you're a comedian, are you? Tell us a joke. That one. And I say, what do you do for a living? And they're like, I'm an accountant. I'm like, would you do my taxes for free?
How does it go down?
Oh, not very good.
Yeah, because it makes you sassy.
A big bitch.
You grew up in Melbourne. Yes. Greensboro, I think it is. Is that
Greensy.
Right? What was your childhood like growing up?
For anyone that's seen my shows knows, it was very regular. But that's where I find my funny. Mm. Just a very traditional, regular, dad works full-time, mum works part-time, you know, dad was the mean one, mum was the fun one.
It's very relatable, though.
Brother, two sisters, punching on all the time, two dogs, swimming pool, just so regular. And in that, I think, is why I find so much relatable material, I think.
What was Nath Valvo like as a kid?
Extremely annoying, energetic, attention-seeking, show pony, you know, nightmare at school. Complete rebel, wagged all the time. It was from the ages of like 12 years old to 15, I think I was figuring out I was pretty different.
Mm.
Didn't, as in i.e. homo. You don't know what that is at that age. So I was really awful to my parents. I was such a prick for a few years, just constantly in trouble. Teachers hated me. My brother was a real nerd. So my older brother was like extremely textbook smart, maths boy, science boy, and he was 3 years above me at my school. And there's nothing worse than having a nerd golden child brother 3 years above. So all the teachers used to be like, why isn't he like his brother?
Don't you think that the dynamics of your siblings can cause that kind of a ripple-on effect for you, where for my brother, anything he could do, I didn't want to do.
Yeah.
Do you reckon that that dynamic was happening for you?
Oh, yeah. And, like, even now, like, he's a very corporate. You know, he lives in London. I use him a lot in my stand-up because I think he's, you know, my parents got it right the first time, so I think they're a bit annoyed that I came along.
But different levels of success is different, though, because, I mean, it's not exactly like they're looking at your brother and going, no, that's amazing.
Well, anyone listening to this podcast that is creative or knows anyone creative, it's hard for us to put in front of people language they understand.
Mm.
Like, if you want to become an accountant, you get this score at high school and then you go to university for 4 years, and then at the end of that 4 years you get a certificate that says you can do this, and so this is how much money you will make, and then you go and get that job, and then you're on your salary. And so it's all so mapped out for people in other industries. But when you're creative, there's no rules, there's no plan, there's no university, there's no piece of paper that says you can do this. So parents struggle with that, and my parents struggled for a long time.
But you could make $1 million knowing that you're an accountant or whatever. You'd have to be a very good accountant. I don't know whose books you're doing. But then, you know, for a comedian, you can make $0 a year, or you can make like a couple of million.
100%. And that's like, it's a nightmare being creative in terms of life, applying for houses or credit cards. You know, you try something to a bank. Oh, I can't tell you how much I'm going to make this year. So everything's quite good now. I'm happy.
You're comfortable.
I'm comfortable, and my parents are a lot happier in the last few years. But that first, like, 5-6 years of doing stand-up, they were just beside themselves about what I was doing.
What was your relationship like with your parents growing up?
It was fine. Like, I feel sorry for them. I just apologise to them all the time now because I was such a prick. I don't know. I think I was angry and scared, and I didn't want to be different.
But what about the dynamics differently to your mum and your dad? Like, would you say that they were... Were you closer to your mum or your dad?
Of course. I'm a gay boy, so I was a little mama's boy.
Well, that's what I'm getting at, because, like, you get to gay boys, and they've got these really strong relationships.
Yeah.
Did you have her on a pedestal?
Well, she just copped it all the time because she was home more, so she had to put up with me. And my mum's a little bit of a hippie, so there were some teachers early on in, like, older years of primary school telling her that I should have been medicated.
Okay, ADHD.
I was one of those kids.
Yeah.
And so the teachers were like, we think he needs to be medicated. And my mum, bit of a 70s kid, was like, no way. You know, I'm not putting him on drugs. Da, da, da. Not that there's anything wrong with that now. And I think now there's a lot more research into what kind of drugs people should take and diagnosis. I think back then that was a bit of a broad brush approach.
Did you have a role that you played in your family?
Yeah, I was just mean. I was just, like, so angry for so long. I got heaps of stand-up when I just used to lock myself in my room and just cry and masturbate and yell at my siblings. I didn't show my family that I could be an entertainer and be funny till a bit later. That's probably came from embarrassment or something.
What were your awkward teenage years like? Were you awkward as a teenager? Because I read somewhere that going through school, someone asked you whether or not you were into drama, and you said, no, I wasn't into drama because I had to hide my weird.
I had to hide the gay. Not the weird. I just had to hide the gay.
Because I grew up in the 90s, so gay was weird.
Yeah, of course. Same. Because, like, I went to an all-boys school, so that gets times by 50. And it's more, high school to me was more survival than anything else. So no drama. None of that gay shit, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, right.
I was funny to my mates and I was an idiot to my mates and impersonated all the teachers and all that kind of stuff, but I was very selective on who I did that to. But then come the class, I just hate, and I still do, it's a big problem I have. I can't stand authority. I was a bit of a liar. I would lie to get my way out of stuff in high school. I once told my teacher that my parents were going through a divorce to get out of homework, Ben. They were very happily married. That kind of kid. What a little bastard, you know?
What age did you start to think about your sexuality then?
Well, I fooled around with a dude from my school when I was like 16. So that was starting to happen at that point.
Wow.
I'm sure there's a lot of guys, gay people in general, listening to this that know denial has many, shows itself in many different faces. And to me, it was excuses. The big word for me for denial was the excuses I would come up with on why I did certain things.
To yourself or to
others? To myself. Okay. So if I was really attracted to a male friend of mine, it was because I was horny. Oh, it's just hormones. And everyone is attracted to everyone when they're 16. Or if I was to hook up with a guy when I went to a gay club when I was 18 off my face, that was because, it's experimenting.
Everyone I was drunk.
I was drunk, and that's what alcohol does. It makes you want men. Two Bacardi breezes and you want a dick, you know what I mean? That should be on the bottle. So I just, for me, it was years and years of really creative excuses. And I have a very creative head, so I was very good at making it anything other than the fact that I was a homer.
When or how did you first see homosexuality? Not your first experience, but when did you start knowing that there was gay people?
Well, TV and movies, obviously. One of my first couple of stand-up shows years ago, me and Tom Ballard had, we ended up figuring out we had the same story in our shows about queer as folk on
wow.
SBS.
Yeah,
when we were very young. 10:30, whatever night it was, whatever day it was, and I'd remember it, and I'd have to watch it so low on volume in my room. The weird thing is, I have heard this story so many times through mates, through other gay comedians, through interviews, maybe yourself.
It's already been on Word for Word about 3 times.
Well, you guys even on this podcast. So just like it is when you hear and when you read articles or when you listen to like whether it be people of colour or any kind of minority saying the importance of representation on TV shows or mainstream media. Yeah, it's like it can affect an entire generation of people if you have the right people on shows.
Do you think there's a relationship with being gay and being creative and comedic? Like, if you look at Josh Thomas, Tom Ballard, Joel Creasy, yourself, what parallels are you putting in there?
I would say I think some of our material obviously crosses because we're all grown up in the same generation. But in terms of does it make us comedians, probably not because there's so many straight male comedians.
It's interesting, though. I think the parallel that I thought might have been there is, you know, what makes gay people want to go into comedy? And I think that we learn humour as a protective barrier.
Oh, 100%. For me, yeah, absolutely. I think the reasons why we get into comedy might be different to a straight guy because it was my tool to make friends in high school and to be the cool guy to my mates at lunch. I was the funny one. It was my thing.
Do you think being gay in comedy is a challenge or has it been a challenge?
The challenge is how pigeonholed producers can be. So we're talking like whether it be auditions and TV shows and radio shows on the commercial networks, there's certain ideas they have that a gay man should be. And you need to tick a few boxes. And when you don't tick those boxes, because that's the way it's always been done, they freak out a little bit or they don't know how to place you in a certain thing. So when you're a straight guy in comedy, you can be so many different things and it's fine. And everyone in the, you know, the industry lets you take risks. You can be the nerd guy or the jock guy or
the stoner.
There's so many different ways you can do your comedy as a straight guy. But when you're the gay guy, there's a certain thing sometimes some people want from you. And if you don't give them that, they're like, well, why aren't you doing what I want you to do as the gay comedian? Mm. Does that make sense?
Mm.
Whether that be doing gossip, talking about the Kardashians, you know. And don't get me wrong, I absolutely love that. And there's a bunch of comedians I love that do all of that material. But there's a bunch of us that don't. And not so much ticket buyers, but the industry can be very hesitant to put you on stuff if you're not giving them the gay they want you to be.
Mm.
And so I've struggled with that. So I've had auditions, I've been put forward for certain stuff or a certain show, and then...
They think you're not gay enough?
Well, basically, yeah.
Or they want you to be more gay?
Yeah, or they haven't given them the gay they expect. Does that make sense? We're getting very complicated and very honest here. But that's, to me, from my point of view, that's the biggest challenge I've had so far in my career.
It's so funny, though, because the gay stories are so different and we are creating a little bit more diversity, and it's okay to be a gossip person if you're a blokey guy. And, I mean, where it should be going.
I buy tickets to those shows. I want to see that as well because I think it's great. But it's... I'm not amazing at it, and I've tried, and I'm just better at other stuff. And when I don't give them that kind of angle, some people can be a bit weird.
Do you think it's easier these days for the queer community compared to what it was like when you were growing up?
I don't know. I would hate to answer that on behalf of them, the youngers.
We don't know what their struggles are.
Like, who's to say? Like, that would be so wrong of me to say. I have no idea how people still feel, how their school is, how their family is. I don't know. Like, all I know is I see a lot of great things. I see a lot of positive sides. I know that, you know, even in my family, I've got young cousins that are still young, 14, 15, 18. They've got gay friends already and they're 15.
See, I think Glee and a few shows like that sort of normalised it a little bit.
Oh, absolutely. So I think from my point of view, I'm seeing a lot of amazing stuff, but I would hate to paintbrush that as a yes and then some people are like, no.
You and I share something, and that's the love of the 90s. Why do you love the 90s so much? Just because you grew up in that era?
I think, that's for the material.
You kind of dress like 90s grunge at the moment.
Sure, I'm 90s grunge today. It's just very natural to me to talk about that era. And when I do my live shows, when I do my throwback 90s stuff, or whether it be a particular concert I went to or a song, it seems to really hit.
It resonates.
With a lot of people.
If you could give a message to young Nath Thalvo, what would it be?
Calm down and take a breath, mate. You're going to be fine, and stop trying to control everything.
That's good advice.
You weirdo.
And do you know what young Nath Thalvo would say to you?
Oh, get f***ed. What do you know? That's what he would have said.
What's been your career highlight thus far?
Oh, man, there's been heaps. And I don't mean that as in I'm so successful. There's been so many little things that have meant so much along the way. So, look, meeting Kylie and getting to interview her, that to me, a moment, just because she was just this gigantic influence on my life, secretly. Kylie was this huge secret in my life for so many years. I think a bunch of us had that. So when I was this angry, weird little emo teenager, I would still go to my room and listen to Kylie. Do you know, I went to her Intimate and Live concert and didn't tell anyone? So I went on a secret mission to go to her. What a little gay adventure that is. Little gay Nate from Greensboro. Trained it into the city, trammed it down to the Palais to see Kylie, that kind of stuff.
What do you think takes to be a good comedian?
Hard work and honesty. Those two things. You need to work your ass off. I get really defensive and offended when people do the comedians are lazy thing, because you got to work pretty hard.
Everyone I know who is a comedian are pretty much the hardest working people I know.
Yeah, we're constantly gigging, constantly writing. And a lot of the gigs are unpaid. I'm not going to complain. I'm happy. Everything's going great. I'm really excited about, you know, the future. But it's hard. I can't tell you the last time I had a drink at a gig.
How did you get started in the comedy business?
I wasn't brave enough to do solo stand-up yet. So me and two mates did a Channel 31 skit show.
Which was called?
The Shambles.
Yeah.
Because before YouTube, Channel 31 was the cult station where everyone would go to find new, you know, like Hamish and Andy were there, Rover just left. Like, it was the place everyone went to create just weird, stupid, crazy stuff. That's all over YouTube now. And then we live toured for like 4 years. So every comedy festival, we would do the live version of the TV show. And then I always wanted to do solo. So then I finally got the balls to do solo stand-up. And the first solo show I ever did was Midsummer.
Wow.
Midsummer Festival.
You thought you'd go and test out the gays first.
Yeah, yeah. And weirdly, which is funny, all these years later, looking back, they're actually a tough audience.
Gay people always feel like if you're in the spotlight or doing something that you're trying to represent them, and there's so many different diverse levels of gay people.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes when I've been doing things, they're like, oh, I don't like that Ben guy because he's not representing the gay community like I am.
Right.
He's bitchy gay. I don't like it. And I'm like, no.
Yeah.
But I think that that's sometimes where it can be a little bit harder.
Sure.
But isn't it a good stomping ground to go to test out your humour and build up some confidence?
Yeah. Well, I had fun. And after I did that Midsummer for the first year ever, this is, I think, 9 years ago now, maybe 10 years ago, the whole show was about f***ing men off. Don't get me wrong, because when you first become a stand-up, girls say the same thing, whether you're an ethnic minority or you're, you know, disabled or you're gay or whatever you think is something about you that is your point of difference, because you get told that's your point of difference. You think when you first start stand-up, it's all you talk about. So all my jokes were just about men. And I still love those stories because I think sex to me is the funniest thing in the world. It is so ridiculous and funny. And when you break it down about what's actually happening in the bedroom when you do have sex, especially when you're single, I find it hilarious. I think it's so funny. You can talk about sex without being crass. Like my show a few years ago that did really well and got, you know, a couple of nominations on this stuff, I had a 10-minute breakdown of how I accidentally had a foursome one night and just walked through the story and how it accidentally happened and what actually happens during one and how it finished and all the real intricate details. There was a comedy goldmine, and it wasn't crass, it was just ridiculous.
What is interesting, I guess, about comedians is that they're always watching other people.
I don't know if you know a comedian, David Quirk, said once, and I was like, oh, you've nailed that. He said a comedian's job is to report back to everyone about what's kind of going on at the moment. So I don't... You know when you meet someone that's, like, good at, like, football, they don't really learn. They just kind of knew how to do it from the start. And like, you know, whether that be someone that's broadcasting on radio, they just kind of got it. I think without knowing it, I've always been... I've always looked at the room and how people are acting, and I always notice weird things without even thinking about it, if that makes sense. And once I started learning how to put that into stand-up, it just came kind of naturally. But my phone notes... it's in the thousands.
Yeah.
I have thousands of notes in my phone, and every couple of months I'll sit down, I'll plug it into my Mac, all my notes will come up, and I have to somehow go through
cipher them
and find stuff that I think could end up being stand-up. But, you know, sometimes I'm not specific enough, and I'll at 3 a.m. have a note that says pigeons. And 3 months later, I'm sitting in my house going, what the hell was funny about pigeons at 3 a.m., you
What's
drunk
not
idiot.
Funny about pigeons?
Well, hello. So, yeah, I don't consciously do it, because that would be a terrible life to go to parties or to socialise or to live kind of standing out, looking in. That would be kind of depressing. So you kind of got to try and work a bit hard on letting go as much as you can to just enjoy the moment. It's really hard to enjoy life, but also be aware of things that could become jokes. Big respect to partners of people in creative industries, because I will often have to say to Cody, my boyfriend, I'm going to have to do stand-up on this because it's really funny. And, you know, we've just had a fight about something or something weird's happened. But I give it a couple of weeks, but then he has to be cool enough with me then touring, you know, doing it all through Australia, and people he knows comes and sees the show, and I have all these stories about our intimate fights or an awkward sex moment, he has to be really cool with it as well. So I always give a big tilt of the hat to partners of people that are comedians or that work in radio and stuff.
There's an incredible license that you also use to embellish stuff as well.
Of course. There's nothing worse than the truth. No, I'm kidding. Yes, but I kind of lean towards the other way, which is you have to keep it truth in the truth, because it gets funnier. So
the more truthful, more awkward.
Yeah, so sometimes I do find myself naturally, we all do it, I'll add some bells and whistles or a bit of light and shade to a story, and I'm like, nah, it's actually taking away from it. And so I always try and go back and just make it as truthful and as honest as possible. And the more you do that, it actually becomes funnier. It really does.
I'm going to take that on board.
Yeah, yeah.
Adam Richard said to me halfway through Word for Word, he was like, Do you want to be a comedian? And he's like, He goes, I've got really good advice. He goes, I could turn anyone into a comedian.
Mm.
So then he started sort of giving me like a tutorial.
That's good.
Obviously, I edited that whole thing out because it was quite obvious throughout the podcast that I was very much not funny and I am not a comedian and did not want to be there.
But I'm not very funny in like person. I think there's a lot of comedians that aren't funny in person.
I think a lot of, we're going off on a tangent here, but yes. I think a lot of comedians that I know are actually quite sad.
Oh, I'm not sad. I'm just not anywhere near as on as I am when I'm on stage, if that makes sense. And there's a bunch of comedians. When I used to do my show on commercial radio on Nova, there was I'm not going to ever name names, but we had a handful of comedians that we never had on the show again because they're so funny, but in person and on radio outside of stage, they just weren't. And they were actually boring. And I'm probably boring to your listeners this week, so sorry.
Not when we edit this podcast, you won't be.
But no, I've had experience interviewing comedians, and I'm like, oh man, you've got to give me more here. Like, come on, like open up or give us something. And so there's a bunch of comedians that are by nature introverted. So
well, yeah. That sort of helps with the observant culture. Do you know what I always found was that the more I liked or was excited to meet someone, the more disappointed I was. And if I didn't like people, I ended up liking them. Like I don't want to name names here, but I remember going to the Logies and Rebecca Gibney was one of them.
Which one was she? Which side? As in you weren't excited, but then she was amazing?
She really let me down in one way.
Oh.
So maybe I can't really tell
Rebecca
you.
Gibney, if you're listening to this, you're a bitch.
Come on. I have to ask you this now. So would you ever go on a reality TV show?
It's a really tough question because... No, the only thing, the reason I hesitate is because our industry, especially in comedy, is we love seeing big audiences at our show. That is what we work for. We love audiences. We love filling our festivals with people. And a really good way to do that, unfortunately, is just to get yourself on a reality show because it opens you up to a whole new audience that wouldn't normally know who you are. So The Jungle, for example... Joel, Nazim, Shannon O'Loughlin had her, you know, rebirth this year. Going on those kind of shows does actually do incredible things for comedians because then once we're on the show, we then have a product, which is our comedy, to make them come and have a look.
So I think you'd be good on The Jungle.
So business speaking, sorry to be really depressing here. From a business point of view, it's a very smart thing to do. Yes, I would just have a huge issue with going on something with the word celebrity in the title.
I think of you as a celebrity.
But that's probably
actually,
why
know what?
I'm blushing.
It's a dangerous zone to get into because for people to claim that they're a celebrity is the most embarrassing
thing.
It's
ridiculous.
I actually went to an event a few weeks ago and I had to tell this friend of mine as we were leaving to stop telling people that he's... I said, if you're telling people at an event that you're a celebrity, you're not a celebrity.
If you have a celebrity in your email address, you're not a celebrity.
Yeah. I mean, really in Australia, because this is the tall poppy syndrome, but really in Australia, when you think of... famous people, for me, I think real celebrities like Hugh Jackman and Nicole Kidman, because then there's no other grey area by confusing people who've been on one season of MasterChef. Because that isn't a celebrity in my mind.
Yeah, look, hey, how long's a piece of string, Ben? Well, all I know is that sometimes you watch those shows with celebrity in the title and unfortunately you say to yourself, who is that person? How have I never heard of that person? And they're a celebrity. I'm definitely that person to so many people. So if I ever went on one of those shows, that would be the weirdness of me thinking that people would know who I am. Does that make sense?
But you've had, like, people know who you are.
Pockets of people.
Certain small...
My family.
Yeah. Mum and dad.
And the guys at Joy. Tick, tick.
Well, we're treating you like a celebrity. Can we get you a coffee? It's instant.
Turn the fucking heating down, Joy. If you think I'm a celebrity.
Yeah, turn the heating down. Get me the hell out of here. What advice do you have for people who are trying to get into the industry?
Really do be prepared to work really hard and to constantly feel like no one's listening to all the good stuff that you're making because it takes a while to break through.
I was going to say, where's your best material come from? Does that usually come from your relationship?
Yeah, whether that be relationships in general. So my friendships, Cody, my family, absolutely. It's a goldmine.
Have you ever lost a friend because you've told a joke that's thrown someone under the bus?
I would never... In my comedy, I always make sure that I'm the loser. So if I have a story where something good happens to me, that's not funny to me, so I wouldn't talk about it.
Yeah, right.
So I would tease a friend... Only if it ended in me also being the loser.
Being the underdog.
I somehow lose as well, then I'll do it. But if I wouldn't just tease that mate for the point of it.
Is there anyone that's really that successful from throwing people under the bus?
The US love it. US comics love winning. The vibrato of being a winner and knocking people down. So the US do love it. Australians don't.
It's so true.
Australians go and see shows with their arms crossed. It's just sometimes your crowd can be a bit like, and I'll give you a bit of an insight. During the comedy festivals and stuff, the international comedians from the UK or America, they all say that Australians are the hardest audiences in the world. The tall poppy thing. But it's not only that, especially we're spoiled. We have so many shows. It's amazing. Musicals, comedy, fringe festivals, cabaret festivals. We are so, so spoiled, especially in Melbourne and Sydney. So when shows are on, there's not a huge amount of like, oh, we're lucky to be here tonight, or we're so excited. Mm. Because the audience has probably seen five other shows this month. Like Edinburgh, the big, huge Edinburgh Fringe, that month is the only month of the year there's anything on.
Where so, for us, we're like, you know, do you want to see a comedy show?
I'm throwing Adelaide under the bus, but my mates that live in Adelaide say the same thing about their Fringe. The Fringe Festival is so amazing and so gigantic for that month. It's because it's pretty slim pickings for the rest of the year. So I love Adelaide audiences. They're always so
ready to laugh,
loud and up for it.
Who are the best Australian comedians at the moment?
Anne Edmonds is the funniest comedian in Australia at the moment, and her character Helen Bedeau from Get Crackin' on ABC. Helen, i.e. Edo, did her first solo show as Helen this year at the festival. It's one of the funniest things I think I've ever seen, and so she's incredible. Becky Lucas is an amazing up-and-coming comedian. I suggest you go and look her up because she's awesome.
Mm.
She has a special on ABC iView.
What about internationally?
So here's the thing, and this is, I'll be completely honest with you, I don't watch much stand-up.
You don't want to be influenced?
Yeah, I don't, and it's work. I see it so much.
Right.
I kind of, very rarely do I put on a Netflix special or watch comedy at home because I just feel like I'm at work.
Yeah, right.
I will say Ali Wong, she has a Netflix special. She's great. So at the moment, that's the last one I've seen that's made me laugh a lot. I it's a bit sad, I suppose. I can't just sit back on my couch and get as much from a Netflix special as I think the regular viewer can, because I just feel like I'm at work. And then I get jealous.
Totally.
John Mulaney's got a show on Netflix at the moment. That's great. But when I watched it, I was like, oh, it's a really good joke. Why didn't I think of that? Or, oh, that's a great set. Why didn't I get that last year? I get really jealous. Comedians do. We're a bitchy bunch.
Is it a competitive industry?
Yeah. Unfortunately, it is, yes.
Do you feel competitive against the gay comedians that are out there, like there's the Joel Creasy?
No. Because the good thing is, and I've always said this about us.
You've slept with them all, so like...
There's that. But there's also... oh, look out, bit of goss. No, the thing is, you could put me, Ballard, Joel, us on the same lineup, on the same show, and you wouldn't hear the same thing twice.
Interesting.
When I say competitive, I just mean there's just not heaps of paid jobs. So everyone stresses a little bit about work.
You've made no secret about the fact that you'd love to host like a Graham Norton-style show. What's the hurdles of getting that started? Because if you look at it...
Do you want to talk about Graham Norton coming to my show?
We should mention that.
Let's talk about that.
Okay, so this is the thing.
Yes.
I love Graham Norton, so go.
Okay, so when I did Edinburgh Fringe last year, I have a rule with my producer to never tell me when someone cool's coming to the show, or definitely don't tell me if reviewers are coming. I don't want to know any of that because you just think about it the whole time. It was this last weekend of Edinburgh Fringe and I just finished my show. It was a good show. It went pretty good. And Cody, my partner, had flown over from Melbourne just for that final weekend with my sister. And they came up to me in the foyer afterwards and just went, Graham Norton just sat next to us in your show. And I just thought, they're smart asses. I was like, can you not lie? I'm tired. This festival's been going for a long time. I'll probably cry. Leave me alone. Like, no. Graham Norton, like, came to your show, man. He was, like, sitting next to us. And then all the questions begin. Did he laugh? Did he do this bit? What bit did he laugh the most at? Da-da-da. And they were like, yeah, it was funny that. And then my producer was like, yeah, he, you know, requested tickets this week, so we've known all week he was coming. And then he tweeted me. It was crazy.
What do you think the hurdles are in getting, like, a comedy show or a talk show with someone like you in Australia?
There is so many comedians and actors and writers and creative people, not just for TV, even stage as well. There are so many people with amazing ideas that work hard on pilots, that work hard on scripts. There are so many of us trying so hard to get things made. One, it's very depressing. There's just not a lot of money anymore in TV. Two, the people that are in charge of TV don't like risks. They hate risks. They won't give a TV show to someone that's not already super famous. They don't like any sort of like new, and there's a bunch of people on TV that deserve to be there because they're awesome, but sometimes you get a little bit frustrated because it's kind of been the same bunch of people.
Why do we have so many old people on these shows? Like, as in, why can't we have shows hosted by 22-year-olds?
Yeah, your frustration is shared by the whole industry. There's this disconnect between the talent that's out there, the amazing work that some people are doing, and then the people that decide what actually goes on your screens. They're the people that are a bit closed-minded.
Right.
But hopefully it will change in the next few years, hopefully with this explosion of pay TV. Hopefully some new and exciting stuff starts to get made.
Well, apparently Love Island's really cheap and it's doing well, so you never know.
I haven't watched that show only because I stay away from those shows because I know if I watch it for a minute, I will be completely obsessed with it. So I have to stay away. It's like heroin. I don't want to try it because I reckon I'll have one little jab and away we go.
What was it like to be nominated for the Best Newcomer Award at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival?
That was crazy. Unexpected. To be called newcomer in your 30s is always good too.
You look young, mate.
So thanks for that. Yeah, the Edinburgh Fringe, I'm sure people know. It's just so crazy and huge. Like the Melbourne Comedy Festival is probably, I'm going to take a shot in the dark here, 200, 300 shows maybe. The Edinburgh Fringe is like 3,000 or 4,000. It's just so big and it just completely takes over that place for the whole month. As the performer, it's exhausting. It's hard. Some nights you have 10 people. Some nights you sell out. Some nights you have 2 people. That same year that I got nominated, I had to cancel a show one night because I had 0 sales. 0. And that never happened to me in my life because you're up against thousands of other shows. It's just chaos. You've got to go to the street with flyers and try and get people to come into your show. And it's not that everyone's a newcomer. You're competing against, like that year, Louis C.K. was there and all the, you know, Alan Carr does shows at Edinburgh Fringe and just like all the huge UK superstars, all the Aussies go over. It's just this like amazing experience, but exhausting and full on.
But so rewarding to get that acknowledgement,
well,
though.
Well, yeah. And then so the month was pretty full on and it was stressful and cool. But that happened at the end and it was just like, oh, whoa. I may have cried a little bit, but not out of like, oh my God, I got nominated for an award. It was more just like, oh, this wasn't a mistake.
Going through your back catalogue, aka your life, what do you remember as being your biggest fail?
Fail as in like comedy or life?
Yeah, just
or
a mistake you made.
Like, how about the time I got back with the guy that absolutely broke my heart and, like, had an affair on me for, like, 6 months? He was completely seeing another guy, and I went back to him. Yeah.
But did you go back to that guy and then break up with him?
No. The second time around, it kind of all just happened again. I was like,
he cheated on you again?
I think so.
What, are you stupid?
Well, you asked me the question.
I didn't say the question was about stupid people.
You know, stuff like that. I've just made, you know, we've all done it. You know, career choices. You know, I've said things that I shouldn't have to people. Plus, I took Nova, the network, off air one night because I pressed the wrong button. It was a national show, so Nova Australia went off air for so long that the emergency backup song had to kick in. But, you know, so there's been many things I have done.
What would you say is the price of fame? And when I say the price of fame, not talking about what we were talking about before about being classified as a celebrity, but now that people do sort of know who you are, like, what are some of the hurdles with that?
Some of the hurdles, especially for being a comedian, this is getting real deep here, but some of the hurdles are my relationship with Cody and my close relationship to a couple of my friends and even family. Sometimes I see they're editing themselves a little bit around me, thinking that this might become content. And to think for a second that, you know, people around me might think that I would use that, that can affect relationships. That's what I've struggled with a little bit. And speaking to some elder comedians, comedians I look up to that have been doing this for a long time, have all shared that relationships are hard, so you've got to put a lot of energy into it.
What would you say has been your greatest achievement?
I'm still not over the feeling of being backstage when front of house will come and say, we've sold out, or full house tonight, or I will never get over that, no matter how many years. Like, this year was my 9th solo show. I don't think I will ever get over when you have a full house.
Who's the sounding board for you? Who's your go-to?
Random audiences. That's why comedians get up during the week and go to the rooms all around Melbourne or whatever state you're listening in. There's a lot of comedy rooms, Sydney, Melbourne, Perth, wherever you are. There's like 3 or 4, 5 good ones a week where you'll see 5 or 6 comedians get up, do 10 minutes each, whatever. Normally it's free or $5 at the door. That's where a lot of us test our material and see if it is connecting and if it lands.
What hurts your ego, though? Like, as in, I mean, apart from that time that you moved back home at the age of 32.
I was only for a month.
How was that for you?
It was fun, actually. Yeah, the best.
Got some good content?
Mum cooked some food. Didn't have to pay bills. It's great. What's wrong with moving back home? Parents love it. Catch up. Hang out. Felt a bit weird having a wank in my old teen room. My feet dangling on the end of my car bed. Bit weird. Okay, I made that up. That didn't happen. I didn't have a car bed. But anyway, let's move on.
So with the love-hate twists and turns of working in this industry, which can be so exhausting, and I'm sure it can be for you, what is it that Nath Velva does to switch off?
So I read like a nerd sometimes, podcasts, just chill. I'm a big sleeper. A lot of comedians are. So I have a theory that meditating is just sleeping. You know, people are like, I meditate. I'm like, shut up, mate. You nap. You just nap. If I'm going to go to the trouble of getting a rug and getting down on all fours or your knees, whatever it is that you do to meditate, just have a nap. It'll do just the same thing. It switches you off.
Maybe that's why you look so young. You look young. You've been sleeping through half your life.
I never see the sun. So I just set my alarm. Never. The key to a nap, people listening, is never go long. 15, 20 minutes max, and it's perfect. I'm not one of these people that goes to have a nap for an hour and a half. Who are those weirdos? That's too long. You may as well just sleep for the night.
Totally. Australia has changed its idea of what sexuality means, and we've obviously been on a bit of a roller coaster over the last few years. Why do you think people for so many years were scared or fearful of a person's sexuality?
Probably would put it down to ignorance. Just think if you like, further you go back, you can go back to a time when it was just one radio with one radio station was all people had, the only insight to the outside world outside their lounge room. And they were never gay people.
Mm.
And then you had TV, but then TV only had a couple of stations and they only had a couple of shows. And then our generation came along and we had to search through SBS at night. And I just think with each generation, they're just being educated way earlier and everything. I hate the word normal, but things are normalised a lot earlier. And I just think there's just more for them to see. And I know this sounds like a real old man thing to say, but I'm even old now compared to like what's going on. Some of my cousins and stuff who like are 15 and 16, they're doing things. They're part of this online stuff. They've got these apps. And I'm like, whoa, what? Huh? What are you talking about? Speak up. I'm even like, and I've always thought that I was one of them, but I'm not even them anymore. And I don't think we have, for the real youngins, the amount of like online communities there are, the amount of YouTube videos there are, the amount of... What freaks me out is when you see YouTube stars on the sides of trams and I've never heard of them and they're famous enough to be on the side of a tram and you go and do your research and you find out that it's this openly gay pop star that's been a YouTube hit for 10 years and there's just so much going on.
So you've been with your partner now, Cody, for 5 years. Where did you meet him?
Cody and I, our story is disgusting and get prepared to vomit in your mouth. We met when we were like 22, 23 through mutual friends. We were really good mates for a really long time. We used to live together. I had boyfriends. He had boyfriends. We had this incredibly close friendship for many years. Every now and then we'd hook up if we were drunk or on it, on the gear. Big night at Peel. We'd come home. Why not? We never thought too much about it. And then some things happened and we hooked up a bit more. And then a few years ago we were like, oh, hang on. Maybe we're not just mates.
Maybe we're lovers.
And we gave it a crack. And so far, so good.
That's so exciting.
How weird is that?
He's a good-looking man. I've just been looking at Instagram photos of him today.
He's a great guy. The best thing about our relationship is that he's so detached from what I do for a living. And this has got nothing to do with that I'm a comedian. This is any job.
Mm.
I think a really cool thing for partners to be is completely different. I think that adds a bit of excitement to the mix. You should be opposite. Not in all the time, but there should be differences in your relationships because that creates a bit of interest, I think.
My partner will not come with me to any media events because he hates anyone that is basically in the media after going to like a couple of them.
Yeah.
Last week was the first in a long time that he actually came, but that was only because he wanted to see the new Jurassic.
Yes.
But he also vetoed basically the red carpet. He went and got his free drink, went and sat in the theatre. And I was like, Ben, this is a really good networking opportunity for me. I would really like to go and speak to these people.
We've had this exact, me and Cody have had this exact chat. He's there for the popcorn of the movie, which is fair enough because Cody works in the medical science industry. He is so disconnected from what I do as I am to him. And it's cool because when we get home at night, we've got different things to talk about, you know?
Have you ever been in a long-term relationship with another comedian?
No.
Because I was going to say that would also be such a huge struggle.
Not long-term. Fair crack. But yeah, it's hard. There's definitely, it's not even just comedian. I think it's hard if you are with someone in the same industry.
What impact did the marriage equality campaign have on you? And the reason why I ask you this is, will you be getting married anytime soon?
My entire comedy festival show that I have just finished, well, this year, my whole show this year was about the effect the yes vote has had on gay people in long-term relationships. The jury is still out. I don't know. I truly do not know if we will get married. I know that we're really happy and we laugh about it and it's all smiles and all good. There's no actual proper stress to our relationship, but it's so, I wish I was better at putting the words in the I don't want to go into gear. That's what I'm trying not to do here right now because I've put so much of my thoughts into jokes. Part of it was, again, about my problem with authority and my issues with being told what to do. And maybe some gay people took comfort in the fact that we couldn't because it gave the relationship a bit of a boundary in a nice way. Mm. Not all the time. And of course we wanted it. Of course we fought hard for it. Of course we were really involved in the campaign and all of that stuff. And we were there on the day at the State Library, all that awesome stuff. But the jokes in my show were stuff like Christmas Day was really weird because I have an Italian family who are very outspoken. They were really putting it on, saying, well, come on. TikTok. Like, what's this all for? What's this been for there? And my sister pulled me aside and was like, you wanted equality, kid? Now here it is, dickhead. Welcome. Why did you fight for this? Why did you want this? Why did you want to do this to your Christmas days? You idiot. You've ruined it all. Kind of jokes.
Are you seriously getting pressure, though, from your family to get married?
100%. 100%. And it's hilarious. It's a great problem to have, but the shtick was, well, that's the new problem now we'll all face.
Totally.
You know when you were a kid and you really fought for something, then when you finally got it, whether that be your Nintendo 64 or a pool, I remember we bullied our parents for years to get a pool, and then we finally got the pool, you really have to enjoy it because you fought for it. So we'd do a thing called guilt swims where we'd be jumping in the pool. It was a 23-degree day, but we're just trying to make our parents see us enjoying the pool. I feel like that with marriage. I don't want to guilt my way into a wedding because I had to fight for it. And all gays listening know this. We have to do a gay wedding. We can't do a regular wedding. We have to have pugs and fireworks and ice sculptures and some sort of old 80s pop star performing at the reception. We have to do a gay wedding. So the pressure is on. We can't deliver just normal. I reckon if I have a regular wedding, I reckon I'll have relatives that will fully be disappointed on the day, like,
just how suburban it's going to be.
I didn't vote for this. I voted for a gay wedding.
I wanted swans.
You know, kind of thing. So that there's a lot of fun in all the pressure. But if I was to get married, it's going to be Cody. He's awesome. He's so lovely and polite and kind.
And he looks good in a suit.
He looks good in a suit. He looks way better than I do naked because he, you know, works out and stuff. You know, and he puts up with me. So if I'm going to do it, it'll be with him. I've just got to go out now and figure out. We all fought for the choice. Now that we've got it, now let's give us long-term relationships some breathing space to figure out if we want it. Can you hear me rambling at the moment because of how nervous I just got?
No, but I like the fact that you feel a little bit nervous because I relate to that as well, because people just come up to Ben and I all the time and they're like, so you got engaged 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's okay. Like, can't we just be celebrating the fact that we're still together?
Yeah,
you know?
Of course. So I don't know if we, I hope, who knows? I just hope we just do whatever it is that we're supposed to do. So I would hope that if we are meant to get married, hopefully we will.
Do you think that after marriage equality has happened that we're going to see more gay out people in media?
I think so.
I want more gay footballers.
Yeah.
If they feel comfortable, don't feel pressure.
Of course. The footballer one is, I think, the measuring stick for Australia at the moment. And it's a big one. Like, just really for a minute, think about that. That there has never been an openly gay AFL footballer. I know it shouldn't be, but to me that says a lot. And annoyingly, the first one who's currently playing that comes out will... That'll be front page news for months. That'll be this defining story for their entire career. So I understand why they would feel pressure to do it and be hesitant, because they probably just want to be really good at footy.
Do you disconnect from any of the cultures of being a gay man? You know, there are certain cultures that we get sometimes stereotyped into. What are the ones that you disconnect from?
I remember when I came out, so stupid. Young gays, we all go through this. When I came out, I used to say to people, how ridiculously homophobic is this? I used to say, I'm gay, but I'm not a bottom. I used to have this... like bottom phobic thing, which is so ridiculous, and that's so something that's we're taught and like hammered into our head that could be like the gayest thing you can possibly do. So I just think for years I was just this like anti bottom guy. How yuck is that? So that's definitely changed.
Content today, Ness Belvoir comes out as a bottom.
No, well, just swing both ways. Life's too short. Get the best of both worlds, I say. And so I think for a while, some, not all, some gays definitely go through a little bit of self-loathing when we first come out. Well, I'm not one of those gays, or the anti-femme and the mask-only kind of vibe. I think I had a bit of that for a couple of years when I first came out when I was 22. So I think it's a very natural thing for us, because we get told that that's bad. We get told that's negative to be effeminate.
I think it is starting to change because, like, these days it's wrong to pigeonhole people, which it should have always been, to pigeonhole someone as being femme or being butch. There's thousands of stories to be told of what it's like to be a gay person.
Yeah.
And most of my really blokey mates are all bottoms. And all of my femme mates are basically all tops.
Of course. And it also comes, like, obviously, who's the bottom, who's the top, that's really simplifying it. But it's such a, you would know, if you zoom out, it's such a bigger problem about effeminate gays and, you know, who's this and who's that. And, oh, I've even heard the sentence, oh, but he's not one of those gays. It's like, what the fuck does that even mean, mate? You know what I mean? We are unified with our love of dick. Put that in a banner. Do you know what I'm saying?
It's actually probably more tough and more painful to be the bottom.
It takes a real man to take a dick. I'll be saying that. If I ever have sons, that's been one of the first chats I have with them. I'll sit them down. Like, it takes a fucking man to chop wood, to build a house and take a dick, son. You know?
I see where you're coming from. Is it hard not to create or feel pressure to create and like an Insta, for you in particular as well, like to create the Insta glamorous lifestyle on social media? Because like there must be a lot of pressure being that you sell tickets that way, you've got to promote yourself. But is there a lot of pressure for you to try and create I'm living the best life?
Oh, no, I just make sure it's funny. Yeah, just funny.
Lead with the joke.
Just as long as there's a joke to be said, I'll do it. So, if, like, I'm bad at Instagram, by the way. I've been trying really hard, guys. I need to get more followers. You know what really annoys me, Ben? I have some very hot friends that have, like, triple the amount of followers I have. And they're, like, accountants and shit. I'm a bloody comedian. But I'm really bad at Instagram. But as long as it's funny, I'll post it. I'll post some serious stuff every now and then, but most of the time it needs to be funny.
I think it's going to be the demise of Instagram, to be honest with you, because it's particularly for like Insta gays with posting like abs and looking beautiful and all that pressure that goes with that. You know, at the end of the day, as much as we like to look at some abs and nice hair, it's really pigeonholing people.
On the flip side, it's really fun looking. Oh, no, here's the really creepy thing. I'm one of those creepy Instagram users that doesn't follow people. When I particularly want to look up someone, I'll just go look them up. Does that make sense? I don't want them to know that I follow them.
You disgust me.
So I'm an Instagram creeper. I'm lurking in the shadows looking at hot people from a distance.
You make me feel sick.
Unless they're my friends, of course. But, you know, it would be nice to say it shouldn't matter, but it's good to look at when you're bored on the tram, Ben. Come on, let's face it.
You're obviously still a regular on the comedy circuit. You're on radio, you're on TV, people can see you out and about. What is next for you?
Well, here's a good thing. I think this is something I'm actually a bit hooked on in our industries. I can't always know what's coming up in concrete because we don't know. And we've always constantly got an audition or that thing was due or that pitch we handed in yesterday, or we're always got two or three little things we're working on to try and get up And we never know if they will. Mm. Last year, we had a couple of things that got really close, and then it doesn't happen. So I've always got gigs. I'm always working live. So I've got festivals coming up. I've got live shows coming up. That will always be a constant, and that's the moneymaker. But then on the other column, it's an unknown. I can't answer it because we just don't know. You know what I mean? A bit of touring coming up. I got asked and invited, which I'm very excited about, to doing Montreal. So I'm doing the Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal. Amazing. There's only a handful of us that get to go do that. And then from that, hopefully some gigs in New York, which is cool. It's going to be happening.
Love New York.
And then a run at London later in the year at the Soho Theatre, which is amazing. So some really cool live stuff coming up. As long as I have live, good live stuff coming up, I'm happy. I'm a bit of a Joan Rivers. If you've seen Joan Rivers' piece of work documentary, she gets her diary out and points to a blank page and says, that is my worst nightmare. The white, those white pages. And that is, of every comedian I know, our fear is not having gigs.
Have you got a message for the queer community that is listening to this right now?
Share stories, laugh, just like take the piss, just have a sense of humour. Like it has been my saving grace from an early teenager laughing, or teasing something, not, you know, teasing in a fun way. You know, take the piss, laugh, chill out a little bit, and stop fighting on each other. There's a fair bit of that going on at the moment. You know, people turning on each other on the left. I hate using the word on the left. You know, if you're on Grindr, get your frickin' no Asians, no femmes. Get that shit off your profile. Let's start with that. Gays, now I'm off on one. All of that stuff, you know what I mean? And if you're just coming out, don't tell people that you're a top only. Because in 10 years' time, you'll realise that was you being homophobic.
Nate Falvo, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you for having me, and thank you to all the bottoms listening.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Ben Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network.
Confidence. We complement each other to balance out what ain't consummate. The consequence of bond that is unbroken, a common fence, a kind of defense you develop to skew connection. If you penetrate a field, it shall yield in a new direction. I was used to texting straight from DMs to wannabe BMs who begin sending illicit pics without requesting. Sketching out her plans of the future she thought was destined. Dodging an ex-man from the past, trying to deflect him. Defecting off of social media, year and a half. Cut her hair, joined a gym, and started a new yoga class. No compassion for the past. Aggressive that lack passion. Tell her to follow back and she'll laugh at you just for asking. She said they only want to try to break down my walls so they can break down my walls. Without love, it'll never happen. I'm like, slow down, watch yourself, love. Slow down, come again, love. Slow down, watch yourself, love. Slow down.
And I told her, please don't confuse me with other fellas you dealt with. And please don't refuse me off information yourself, Skip. You know that it takes more than a first impression, a reverse conjecture, to understand when a person's stretching the truth. We need a larger sample size. And please don't expect me to bear the weight from your past baggage with random guys. You can't surmise from a couple of bad apples that grabbed at you, and that's indicative and say that we all a hassle. I had to grapple with separation and crazy exes that tried to haggle my current woman and say I'm reckless. To say I'm a skeptic is an understatement. The underlying blatant truth is we all need to be somewhat patient. Some would say that love's a gamble. I disagree. Love's an investment, a stock exchange, and the currency seat of the person that holds the power. Guard your heart and you can still get devoured. Take a chance with me. Slow down, slow down. Watch yourself, love. Slow down, slow down. Come again, love. Slow down, slow down. Watch yourself, love. Slow down, slow down.
SER wishes to acknowledge the custodians of the land from which we broadcast, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the Wadumatagal clan of the Darug Nation.